Chapter 12. The Aztecs. Circa 1325 to 1521. On the night of the 21st of February, 1978, in the center of Mexico City, a group of workmen from the city's electric company were digging through the asphalt at the corner of República de Guatemala and República de Argentina Street. At first, it seemed like just another job. But then, over 2 meters down, their diggers struck something. It was an enormous piece of carved stone, decorated with intricate patterns. Archaeologists soon descended on the area, and as they excavated further, they found that the stone was a disc over 3 meters in diameter. On its surface was carved the image of a female deity, naked and decapitated, her disembodied head adorned with a crown of feathers, surrounded by snakes and skulls. This was a depiction of a god named Coyolxauhqui, who had been worshipped by the indigenous people of Mexico. And it soon became clear that the disc stood at the base of an enormous pyramid. This was the main temple of a city that had been completely erased beneath the streets of the modern metropolis, a city that had once been called Tenochtitlan. It was the heart of a powerful society, known today as the Aztec Empire. The fall of their civilization, one of the most remarkable and bloody stories in human history, would mark the turning point in the European conquest of the American mainland, as the two long-separated sides of the world met for the first time. The Atlantic Ocean is the youngest of the world's 5 oceans. It began to form during the late Jurassic period, approximately 150 million years ago, following the breakup of the supercontinent Pangaea that had once united much of the world's landmass. When the Atlantic first started to rip this continent in two from north to south, dinosaurs still roamed the earth. This ocean would grow by 3 centimeters a year as the tectonic plates pulled apart at the mid-Atlantic ridge, and the Americas were gradually torn away. The Atlantic Ocean was already around 2,500 kilometers wide by the time the dinosaurs were wiped out by the Chicxulub asteroid impact about 66 million years ago, which struck the Earth just off the coast of Yucatan in southern Mexico. The ocean kept growing as the planet's large animal life recovered from that catastrophe, and all modern mammals diverged from our small, rat-sized ancestors. Since the earliest known fossils of Homo sapiens entered the archaeological record around 300,000 years ago, the ocean has grown by 9 kilometers. Today, the Atlantic stands at 4,800 kilometers wide in places, with its narrowest point about 2,800 kilometers near the equator. And across this great gulf of time, it has formed a barrier between the Americas and the continental landmass of Afro-Eurasia. How and when humans arrived in the Americas is a question that is being constantly updated and revised as new evidence emerges. And just as in Europe, the story is likely one of multiple waves of settlement that left varying impacts. New evidence of fossil footprints in White Sands National Park in New Mexico suggests that humans were present in the Americas from at least 20,000 years ago, and the most comprehensive mitogenomic DNA studies have shown that the people of the Americas arrived from Northeast Asia in the region of Siberia, and diverged from those populations between 24,900 and 18,400 years ago. These populations either crossed a land bridge in the region of the Bering Strait, exposed by the low sea levels of the last ice age, or travelled along the Pacific coast in canoes. From there, they occupied the entire continent. Much of this story will take place in a landscape known as the Valley of Mexico, a highlands plateau in central Mexico, sandwiched between two great ranges of mountains and volcanoes. Archaeology suggests that the earliest humans arrived here around 12,000 years ago, when the valley floor was still covered with a great body of water, 80 kilometers long and 40 kilometers wide, Lake Texcoco. The earliest people found vast herds of mammoths roaming the pine forests bordering the Great Lake, and hunted them, fished, and set up simple communities. Agriculture began around the lake about 7,000 years ago, and by 1200 BCE, a number of large villages coalesced. To the north, the lands of the Chihuahuan Desert were tough and arid, and so over time, countless migrating peoples and nomadic groups traveled south into the valley. As we saw in Chapter 7 on the Maya, the great society of Teotihuacan had once grown up in the Valley of Mexico, and they were followed by the Toltecs, who reached prominence from 950 to 1150 CE. By 1300, the dozens of settlements around the lake had grown into powerful city-states in their own right, each with a tall, pyramid-shaped temple at its heart, booming markets, and sophisticated methods of farming. A thick traffic of canoes crisscrossed the lake, bringing trade between the markets of these cities. At this time, a people known as the Tepanecs had gained a hegemony over the valley, ruling a network of allies and client states from their city of Azcapotzalco, which rose on the western bank of the lake. At least 40 other cities paid tribute to them and sent soldiers to fight in their armies. It was around this time that a new band of migrants arrived in the valley, claiming to have fled from a land called Aztlan. They had been wandering in the deserts for many years, searching for a new place to call home. They called themselves the Mexica, but today they have become known by a name derived from their mythical homeland, the Aztecs. We can imagine how these weary desert travelers must have felt when they crested the hills and saw the wide green valley of Mexico, the cities scattered around the lake, glittering like jewels. They would give it the name Mezdliapan, or the Lake of the Moon, but they would struggle to find a home here. The steady flow of people migrating south meant that nearly all the land in the valley had already been claimed. The Aztecs were a rough bunch. They didn't wear the embroidered clothes of the city dwellers or have their sophisticated manners, and their years in the wilderness had made them tough. They worshipped a fierce, warlike god named Huitzilopochtli, whose name meant hummingbird of the south, and followed rites of blood sacrifice with apparent enthusiasm. According to myth, their god Huitzilopochtli reassured them, "I will lead thee to the place to which thou art to go. I will appear in the guise of a white eagle. When I arrive there, I will alight, and there thou wilt see me. So presently make my temple." According to the myth, it was around the year 1325 that they finally saw their sign. A white eagle with a snake held in its beak, perched on a cactus on an inhospitable strip of marshland, lying some way off the western shore of Lake Texcoco. This was now the only uninhabited land left in the valley. The Aztecs built canoes and paddled out to this lonely stretch. There, they built a small number of huts and a reed altar to their god Huitzilopochtli. The Mexica named this humble settlement after one of their legendary kings, a man named Tenoch, who had led them through the desert. This was the birth of Tenochtitlan. "Now we have reached our promised land," the god Huitzilopochtli tells them. Here you must keep guard and wait, and the four corners of the earth you must conquer. Over the years that followed, the Mexica set about the task of improving their meager sandbank. They built artificial islands out in the lake, driving tall stakes into the shallow lake bed, then piling earth within them. Over the years, these new islands spread out from the original center in a chaotic pattern, connected by bridges and canals. The people of Tenochtitlan also created island gardens called chinampas, on which they grew all kinds of crops, from maize, beans, and squashes, to tomatoes, chili peppers, and flowers. The farmers paddled between these gardens in their canoes, carrying sprouting plants and tools, bringing back the crops in baskets. Remarkably, this island city grew at enormous speed. By 1450, little over a century since the traditional date given to its founding, it housed as many as 200,000 people. By this time, Tenochtitlan would have looked something like an enormous Venice, a lattice of canals and waterways joined to the mainland by three stone causeways to the north, south, and west. The city spreads, making circles of emerald, one Mexica poet would write, scattering splendors like feather of Quetzal, in her there is coming and going of barges. Fed by mountain springs, Lake Texcoco was unusually salty, and the Mexica had to build dams that separated the salty lake water from the drinkable freshwater that ran into it. Salt production became another key local industry. They take the lake water, which is salty, and lead it through ditches into depressions where they thicken it, wrote the Spaniard Pedro Martir de Anglería. Once thickened, they boil it and then form it into balls and loaves, which they take to markets or fairs. As well as farming, the Mexica would have fished and hunted wild birds and deer. They also ate several species of insect, including one they called the Axayácatl, a kind of marsh fly. Francisco Hernández de Toledo relates how the Mexica prepared this food. The Axayácatl is a small yacustrine fly collected with nets from the lake in such great quantities that great numbers of them are cut up and mixed together to form little balls, which are sold in the markets throughout the year. The Indians cook them in salty water wrapped up in maize husks, and prepared in this way, they comprise a good food, abundant and agreeable. The rough bunch of Mexica warriors who had first arrived in the valley were now a sophisticated and settled people. With a central role in the canoe-based trade of the lake, they now enjoyed all the comforts of settled society. Fine emeralds, the stones of much value, the gold and silver, the fine feathers, the fine cocoa which has come from afar. They had also successfully adopted the Toltec and Teotihuacan traditions of pyramid building and stone carving. They welcomed craftsmen and engineers from all the other cities of the valley. And in 1418, the Mexica began the construction of a vast series of aqueducts, stretching for 4 kilometers across the lake to bring drinking water into the heart of the city from the freshwater springs at Chapultepec. After the first aqueducts were damaged by a flood, they would be replaced with a more durable set of aqueducts built from stone. An enormous dam was also built to protect the city from seasonal flooding. Tenochtitlan was divided into a number of key districts. In the north, there was Cuepopan, or the place where flowers bloom, and in the west, Moyotlan, the place of the gnats. To the east was Atzcoalco, the place of the herons. The small marshy island where the Mexica had first settled was now the grand temple district of Teopan, or the place of the gods. Here, the majority of palaces, temples, and schools for noble children were found. In place of the small reed shrine that had once stood there, an enormous pyramid now rose at the head of a grand courtyard, measuring half a square kilometer. The great stone disc with the image of the moon goddess Coil Xauqui, which would one day be uncovered by a group of Mexico City electrical workers, now formed the base of the steps leading up to the pyramid. Tenochtitlan was a place of pleasure and luxury. It had a botanical garden and even a zoo, which Spanish visitors later found remarkable, since nothing of the kind yet existed in Europe. Drinking alcohol was strictly forbidden in Mexica society, but people surreptitiously drank pulque, a particular kind of milky alcohol drink brewed from the agave plant. If you walked the streets of Tenochtitlan, you might also see groups of people eating hallucinogenic mushrooms or drinking them brewed into a tea. These were used especially among poets and priests, for whom they took on a religious significance, as one piece of oral poetry records. I have drunk fungus wine and my heart weeps. On earth I have only pain. It matters nothing. We are all together precious jewels of the God strung on a thread. We are all together jewels of his necklace. One of the most remarkable of the city's sites could be found in its northern part. Here in the district of Tlatelolco, a great market was held. This city in the lake had now become the crossroads of trade in this region, with boats coming from all the lakeside cities to sell their produce. An enormous, colorful variety of food, including sweet potatoes, manioc, sapote, guavas, avocados, plums, acacia beans, tortilla flatbreads, turkey meat and eggs, fish and other goods, were brought from all over the valley and beyond. The Aztecs loved riddles, and while the market goers mingled, they may have laughed and exchanged new ones they'd heard that week. Some examples of these Aztec puzzles were written down by the Spanish friar Bernardino de Sahagún in the 16th century. What thing and thing goes through a valley and carries its guts dragging? This is the needle and its thread. What thing and thing is 10 stones that someone has on his back? These are the fingers and their nails. What thing and thing is a mirror in a house made of pine branches? This is the eye with its lashes. But the darker side of Tenochtitlan would have been immediately apparent to any visitor. Arriving at the market of Tlatelolco, it would have been hard to ignore the imposing pyramids that rose from the district of Teopan, and at the head of these was the one that today is known as the Templo Mayor, or Great Temple. At the top of the 114 steep steps of this pyramid, peaking at a height of 60 meters, were two shrines, one painted blue, the other a deep dark red. The blue painted shrine was dedicated to the god Tlaloc, whose name meant wine of the earth. He was the god of rain and fertility, the god of life. But the great red temple was dedicated to the fearsome hummingbird god and patron of the Mexica, Huitzilopochtli. The steps leading down from both shrines would have been darkened by a cascade of dried blood. The Aztecs believed that Huitzilopochtli took the form of the sun, and every day chased his siblings, the moon and stars, across the sky. They believed that if he ran out of energy for this chase, the world would end, and there was only one way to keep him moving. In the Aztec view, every living being had a fragment of the sun lodged in their heart, which was why the body gave off warmth and life. They believed that cutting out the heart of a sacrificial subject and burning it in offering to Huitzilopochtli gave him the energy he needed to continue his chase. For the purpose of sacrifice, the Aztecs bred several animals: dogs, eagles, jaguars, and deer. The cult of the god Quetzalcoatl even required the sacrifice of butterflies and hummingbirds. But the Aztecs are most infamous for their sacrifice of humans. As we've seen, humans were sacrificed for religious purposes in various societies around the world and throughout Mesoamerican history. In Mexica society, this was done in a wide variety of ways, but the most common was for a sacrificial victim to be brought to the top of one of the pyramids in Tenochtitlan, where a priest would plunge an obsidian dagger into the victim's chest to remove the heart. The still pulsating heart was placed in a bowl and burned, allowing its energy to return to the sun. Meanwhile, the body was thrown down the steps of the pyramid, dismembered, and fed to the animals in the city zoo. It's impossible to know the full extent of this bloodthirsty practice before contact with Europeans. Sacrificial victims were usually prisoners of war, captured during battle with rival states. Warfare in the Aztec world was a highly ritualized affair, fought with wooden clubs and obsidian spears, and Aztec soldiers were generally not aiming to kill their enemy on the battlefield. Their main goal was to capture men and bring them back to Tenochtitlan to be sacrificed. For a pubescent boy, capturing his first enemy for sacrifice was considered a rite of passage. After taking two prisoners, he would be allowed to wear sandals into battle and would be rewarded with a feathered cloak. At four captives, he would be given a jaguar skin to wear into battle. Jaguar warriors held a similar position to European knights, and climbing this ladder was the only way that a commoner could enter the nobility. Eventually, he could be promoted to the rank of eagle warrior, the military elite of the Mexica, and would go into battle wearing a beaked helmet and resplendent feathers. This system has led some to argue that, while a grisly spectacle, Aztec sacrifice did little more than relocate the casualties of conflict. While an old world battle might have seen tens of thousands killed on the battlefield, an Aztec conflict produced relatively few battlefield casualties, with the associated killing taking place publicly in the heart of their cities. It's impossible to say how the ordinary Mexica felt about the practice of sacrifice, but their feelings were doubtless varied and complex. Spectators may have watched with a mixture of fear and fascination, as European peasants once spectated our own grisly, drawn-out public executions of traitors and heretics. Many may have reveled in the bloody spectacle, while others turned away. While we can never really know the answer to this question, one thing is for sure: the practice of human sacrifice was about to increase sharply, thanks to a dramatic change in the political landscape of the Valley of Mexico. The dramas of the Aztec kings can be pieced together from various sources. Chief among them are the Spanish friars Diego Durán and Bernardino de Sahagún, who both worked closely with indigenous Mexica to write down long accounts of their history during the 16th century, resulting in large compendia of Nahuatl mythology, language, and culture, the Durán and Florentine codices. Other sources include the part Nahua historians Fernando Ixtlil Xochitl and Chimalpahin Cuatlehuanitzin, who wrote down what could still be gleaned from oral culture around the start of the 17th century. At the time our story begins, around the year 1420, the Tepanec people still ruled over much of the Valley of Mexico, and the island city of Tenochtitlan was under their thumb. The Tepanecs had a powerful army, supplied with warriors by more than 40 cities. Their capital city of Azcapotzalco had apparently got its name, Anthill, due to its huge population, and it controlled the shore of the lake right where the great causeways of Tenochtitlan met the land. As a result, they essentially controlled all traffic in and out, taxing the island city heavily and exacting tribute from it. One factor in the Tepanec's success was the long reign of their current king, Tezozomoc. According to accounts, by 1420, Tezozomoc was already over 100 years old. He had ruled in Azcapotzalco for more than 50 years, and had held on to power with a combination of military might and targeted assassinations. The tyrant Tezozomoc had himself proclaimed emperor, granting many favors to his allies and confederates, writes Fernando Ixtlil Xochitl. However, most of the lords of the remote provinces were increasingly rebellious. At one point, fearful of the rising power of Tenochtitlan, this king attempted to devastate them with a demand for increased tribute. O people of Azcapotzalco, you have seen how the Aztecs are rising, becoming proud. They are trying to get ahead of us. Lest they rise more, let us order them to pay double the usual tribute. The king was astonished when the wealthy Mexica fulfilled his demands, but their resentment was clearly rising. While the tyrant Tezozomoc ruled, the Tepanecs were able to suppress this resistance around the lake, but in 1426, King Tezozomoc died. The body of Tezozomoc was burned, Ixtlil Xochitl recounts, and his ashes placed in the main temple of Azcapotzalco. His death led to a succession crisis when one of his sons, Maxtla, seized the Tepanec throne. As the Tepanecs devolved into civil war, the subjugated cities of the lake saw their chance and soon rose up in rebellion. At the heart of this resistance was the city of Tenochtitlan. At this time, the king of the island city was a man named Itzcoatl, or Obsidian Serpent. He formed an alliance with a young exiled prince named Netzahualcoyotl from the city of Texcoco on the other side of the lake, a boy with a Hamlet-like story whose father had been killed by Tezozomoc and who would become famous for his poetry. Together, the two kings of Tenochtitlan and Texcoco gathered a huge army of lakeside peoples. The war that followed raged on for 2 years. At first, the Tepanecs besieged Tenochtitlan, hoping to take out the island city and thereby destroy the resistance. But the lake city was exceptionally well placed to withstand a siege. The Tepanecs could only cut off the supplies arriving by land, and a steady stream of goods and reinforcements would have easily passed in and out of the city by canoe. The city held out until King Itzcoatl arrived with his enormous army of allied cities and sent the besieging army packing. The Tepanecs' retreat quickly turned into a rout, and the combined armies of Itzcoatl and Netzahualcoyotl marched on their capital of Azcapotzalco in the year 1428. All of the Mexica lords assailed Maxtla's men relentlessly until they were broken and defeated, Ixtlil Xochitl writes. They were forced to flee and many died as they were being pursued. Netzahualcoyotzin's forces entered the city and destroyed and razed it, tearing down the temples and the largest houses. The usurper Maxtla was dragged back to Tenochtitlan and killed at the top of its great temple. The era of Tepanec rule was over, and now a new power ruled in the valley. This new power, formed from the alliance between Netzahualcoyotl's Texcoco, Itzcoatl's Tenochtitlan, and the junior partner of Tlacopan, would become known as the Triple Alliance. Together, these three cities would rule over the Valley of Mexico and form the foundation of what would one day come to be known as the Aztec Empire. With his Tepanec enemies crushed, King Itzcoatl settled down to the business of ruling. Helping him in his task was his nephew, a Machiavellian figure known as Tlacalel. Tlacalel was the kingdom's Chihuahcoatl, the highest political position below the king. In fact, he would hold this position through the reign of four subsequent kings, apparently declining the crown multiple times. During this tenure, he acted as a reformer and modernizer, improving the Aztec state's administration and taxation. He also had a quite modern understanding of the importance of propaganda, and destroyed any historical texts in the library of Tenochtitlan that undermined his king's legitimacy, as remembered in the Florentine Codex. Once they used to keep a record of their history, but it was burned at the time when Itzcoatl reigned in Mexico. It was agreed, and the nobles of Mexico said, "It is not fitting that all the people should know the paintings. The common serfs will be led astray, and the earth will be made crooked, because in the documents are many lies." Tenochtitlan soon eclipsed the other parties of the Triple Alliance, and Tlacalel had the ambition of establishing it as an imperial power to surpass anything the Tepanecs had achieved. To do this, he enacted various religious reforms in the empire. The god Huitzilopochtli, the god of war and the sun, had always been the patron god of the Mexica, but worship of this deity soon rose to supplant all others. The power of the military increased, and human sacrifices became a daily affair in the empire, reaching an industrial scale. It was the dawn of a new militaristic age in Mexico. During the time of Tlacalel, the Aztec Empire sent armies marching out beyond the volcanic sierras to conquer even farther territories. "He was the beginning and foundation of this edifice," writes the Nahua chronicler Chimalpahin. "This man had the spirit and daring to succeed in making lords of the Mexica people and republic, mistress and subduer of the greater and best part of all the New World." The empire was a network of tribute that saw wealth flow from subjugated peoples into the city of Tenochtitlan. After conquering the city of Chalco, its people gave the following profession of subjugation: "O Mexica, now that we shall be your vassals, we can serve you by providing you with wood for your buildings, stone, loads of earth, carved canoes, laborers to till your lands and masons for your works, brave, spirited soldiers for your wars, and foodstuffs and campaigns." The administration of this empire was conducted over a network of well-maintained roads. With no horses, messages were carried by a relay system of runners stationed at 4 kilometer intervals, allowing communication along the whole length of the empire in only a day or two. Aztec rule was uncompromising and violent. In the villages they conquered, their soldiers and tax collectors were hated, their squashing of any resistance brutal. "Tenochtitlan was a beautiful parasite," writes the historian Inga Clendinnen, "feeding on the lives and labor of other peoples and casting its shadow over all their arrangements." There was one people, the Tlaxcalans, who lived just over the mountains to the east in the valley of Tlaxcala, whom the Aztecs treated with unmatched cruelty. The Tlaxcalans remained independent, but they were at a constant state of war with the Aztec Empire. The Aztecs blockaded them so that no luxury goods such as salt or fine textiles could be brought into their lands. They were kept as a captive, besieged population and forced to compete each year in ritualized battles known as flower wars, so called because flower in the Nahuatl language was associated with notions of poetic or noble deeds. For these events, the Mexica warbands dressed in their most extravagant clothes, carrying shields hung with feathers and embroidered with heraldic symbols, in orange cloaks and red hats, wearing masks, tassels, and jangling bells. In the midst of the plain, they are beautifying themselves in the image of gilded birds, wrote one Mexica poet. They make glory out of the beautiful songs, the beautiful flowers. But the stakes in the flower wars were very real. Warriors would have carried spears, obsidian daggers, and heavy-bladed macuahuitl, and with these weapons they would beat their enemies into submission and drag them back to Tenochtitlan, where their blood would stain the steps of the great temple. After a flower war, the skulls of the captured prisoners were displayed as grisly trophies on enormous racks called tzompantli in the city of Tenochtitlan, some of which have been excavated by archaeology. The largest ever found contained over 650 skulls. When the shadowy chief advisor Tlacalel died, aged 90, the island city of Tenochtitlan presided over an empire that stretched from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. It governed the lives of as many as 6 million people, but like the Tepanec Empire before them, like the Assyrians and Carthaginians on the other side of the world, many of its subjects harbored a bitter hatred for the Mexica. Some, like the Tlaxcala, would have taken any opportunity to throw off their yoke. Around this time, the Florentine Codex recounts that a great omen appeared in the sky over Mexico. A comet of dazzling brilliance. Like a flame, a tongue of fire, as if it were showering the light of the dawn. It appeared as if it were piercing the heavens. This comet would be remembered as a harbinger of doom. In little over 30 years, the people of Tenochtitlan would encounter another power that would outmatch them in military force, in ruthlessness, and at times in cruelty. An alien power from across the Great Sea that would bring about the end of the Aztec Age. As we saw earlier, Stone Age humans had likely crossed into the Americas by 20,000 years ago, during the last ice age. When the planet's climate warmed and sea levels rose, the North Pacific crept in to separate Asia and the Americas. The world's humans were then separated into two populations, one on each of the world's large landmasses. One day, these populations would meet again, and the developments they had made during the intervening millennia were to determine which would survive the encounter. For a number of reasons, the people who settled in the smaller landmass, the continents of the Americas, were at an inherent disadvantage. For one thing, the Old World landmass is more than double the size of the Americas, and its population was much larger. The people of the Americas had simply arrived in their lands later than other humans. We evolved as a species in Africa between 800 to 300,000 years ago, and at some point in the last 200,000 years or so, began to migrate out of Africa, following the River Nile and crossing the Red Sea, and on to the rest of the world. We reached southern Asia and China by about 80,000 years ago, and most of Europe by 30,000 years ago, pushing out species of archaic humans who lived there. This means that modern humans had already settled in virtually the whole Afro-Eurasian landmass for tens of thousands of years, before they ever set foot in the Americas. By the 5th century CE, while the empire of Teotihuacan had only just reached its height and was interfering with the Mayan city of Tikal, the old world had already seen millennia pass that had seen the rise and fall of the Sumerian, Egyptian, Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian, and Roman empires. By the year 1200, a century before the Mexica had even arrived in the Valley of Mexico, China alone had surpassed 140 million people, probably more than double the population of the entire Americas. This head start alone may have proven decisive, but the Old World enjoyed numerous other advantages that would compound the technological discrepancy. One of these was in animal life. There were only two animals in the Aztec world that could be domesticated, turkeys and dogs. But in the Old World, livestock like goats, cattle, and pigs contributed greatly to the amount of protein available to the population, with powerful animals like the ox, camel, and elephant also being useful as pack and draft animals. In the Old World, horses also provided human societies with an enormous amount of muscle power and allowed speedy communication and travel across long distances, as well as spurring the development of accompanying technologies like the wheel. Many of the peoples of the Americas were perfectly aware of how to construct a wheel, and there are many examples of Mexica children's toys with perfectly engineered wheels. But without draft animals to pull carts, the wheel didn't save much work and was never applied to larger vehicles. Instead, like the Maya, the Aztecs carried things with leather straps fitted onto their foreheads, which tied up large numbers in manual labor. The north-south orientation of the Americas also means that travel between its large societies required crossing various climate bands and made the establishment of long-range trade networks more difficult. In the Old World, the east-west trade route of the Silk Road allowed convoys of pack animals to transfer goods between distant lands while remaining within a relatively consistent climate. And technologies and innovations would travel along those roads too. This meant that if something was invented in China or India, it would only be a matter of years before it would be available in Europe, and vice versa. Meanwhile, innovations in the Americas, like the complex alphabet of the Maya or the bronze working of the Inca, didn't travel far beyond their borders. The exponential curve in the development of technology meant that small head starts could compound into significant discrepancies, and we can see these advantages play out in real time. While bronze making began in India and the Near East around 3300 BCE, experimentation with bronze work was only just getting started in Mexico when Tenochtitlan was at its height in the 14th century. High carbon steel was invented in South India in the 6th century BCE and soon spread around the Old World. It would never be struck upon in the Americas. When the Toltec Empire declined in the Valley of Mexico in the 12th century, the people of China had already invented gunpowder and a magnetic compass for use at sea. By the time the Aztec emperors Itzcoatl and Netzahualcoyotl were born, the first handheld cannons had been invented in northeastern China, and naval artillery had been used for the first time in Korea. By the height of their reigns, the arquebus had already been developed in Spain. While Tlacalel was advising the kings of Tenochtitlan and reforming the Aztec state, the Ottoman Sultan Mehmed the Conqueror used his enormous bronze cannons to tear down the walls of Constantinople. One technology above all others would prove to be the decisive factor in the coming collision of worlds, and that was the ocean-going caravel and its larger successor, the carack. Until the 1400s, Old World sailors had been largely restricted to sailing around coasts. But developments in naval technology would soon produce large, durable ships with as many as 6 sails and capacious holds, well-suited for long ocean-going expeditions. A complex system of rigging allowed for greater control and more sophisticated sailing techniques, and lateen sails meant that even the slightest gust of wind could be caught. With this new ship, regular voyages would soon take place between Europe and India, all around the coast of Africa, and eventually to China. In the final decades of the 15th century, the European countries that looked out over the Atlantic Ocean, England, France, Castile, and Portugal, began to wonder if there existed a shortcut to these lucrative markets, a shortcut across the Great Gulf of the Atlantic itself. In 1492, only 5 years after the death of Tlacalel in Tenochtitlan, a carrack called the Santa Maria set sail, supported by 2 smaller caravels. On board was a man who, in his native Genoese, was known as Cristofor Colombo, in Spanish, Cristobal Colón, in Italian, as Cristoforo Colombo, and in English, as Christopher Columbus. The collision of worlds was underway. There were 2 principal actors in the great drama that is about to unfold. The first is the most wealthy and powerful man in the world, at least as far as he knows. He is the king of the Aztecs, Moctezuma II. Like many Mexica of his time, Moctezuma had dark wavy hair, an aquiline nose, and a large forehead. His name meant Lord frowns in anger, but witnesses recall that his voice was eloquent, courteous, and diplomatic, though he often spoke so quietly that the movements of his lips could barely be seen. Moctezuma was the 9th Tlatoani, or king of Tenochtitlan, and came to power in 1502 at the age of 35, when the empire was at the height of its power and confidence. For his coronation, Moctezuma first went into a spiritual retreat, fasting and praying in the temples, and then emerging to a raucous ceremony, with music, dancing, feasts, and the arrival of visiting nobility from all over the Aztec lands. After the coronation, it was traditional to go to war. Moctezuma crushed a number of rebellions and brought many captives back to Tenochtitlan to be sacrificed, alongside a heap of tribute and spoils. The blood would have run down the steps of the temple for days. Moctezuma would have worn a headdress made of shimmering green quetzal feathers, and we can imagine the cheering of the crowds as the new emperor raised his hands, and all the lands of the Aztecs bowed down beneath him. To find the second actor, we must travel nearly 9,000 kilometers to the east. In 1502, as Emperor Moctezuma donned his headdress and climbed the steps of the great temple to be crowned, a sickly, irritable boy of 17 was sitting at home in the village of Medellin in western Spain. The boy's name was Hernán Cortés. He was born a Hidalgo, a class of people with noble ancestry who didn't own any land, and whose sons therefore had little to inherit. He was a source of trouble to his parents as well as to himself, writes his 16th century biographer, Francisco López de Gómara, for he was restless, haughty, mischievous, and given to quarrelling. He was a womanizer and loved to gamble, a habit that never left him. Columbus had landed in the Caribbean when Cortés was only 7 years old, and by the time Cortés reached 18, the Florentine explorer Amerigo Vespucci had suggested that the lands discovered by Columbus were not the edge of Asia as had previously been thought, but an entirely new landmass, one that would eventually be named after him. The relatively new technology of the printing press had spread this idea all over Europe. When deciding whether to travel to the New World or go to fight in Italy as a mercenary, de Gomera writes that Cortés decided on the Indies because it struck him as the more promising on account of the quantity of gold that was being brought from there. Cortés set sail in 1504 at the age of 19, arriving 2 months later on the island of Hispaniola, where Columbus had first landed in the New World. Columbus actually went to his grave, insisting that he had reached Asia as he had hoped to, and had not discovered a new continent. An ironic detail, considering that this is the achievement we remember him for. Nevertheless, his colonization of Hispaniola had set the pattern for the settlement of the New World. The native population had been enslaved and worked to death extracting gold for the settlers, before being all but wiped out by European diseases to which they had no immunity. Partly as a result of the loss of this native workforce, enslaved Africans would begin to be transported from 1501. Cortés must have stepped off the ship into a steamy nightmare, full of the sick and dying, a place where some laboured in chains and others got filthy rich. But it's clear he appreciated the opportunities this new world could offer. He stayed in Hispaniola for 6 years, working as a notary and learning the law, before joining an expedition in 1511, led by a man named Diego Velázquez de Cuellar, to conquer the neighboring island of Cuba and repeat there what had been done in Hispaniola. The native population was massacred, cut down from over 100,000 people to barely more than 20,000 in only the first few years, and again to 2,000 quickly after that. Cortés was the clerk to the treasurer of the expedition, responsible for noting down profits acquired and ensuring that the Spanish crown got its quinto real, or royal fifth, the 20% tax it levied on all loot taken in the New World. When the invasion of Cuba was complete, Velázquez became its first governor, and he was sufficiently impressed with Cortés's bookkeeping and legal knowledge that he appointed him as personal secretary, gifting him a large estate, including gold mines and many more enslaved people to work for him. But it's clear that the ambitious Cortés was beginning to grate on Governor Velázquez. In 1517, an expedition led by one Francisco Hernández de Córdoba explored the coast of Mexico for the first time and met Mayan people living on the north coast of the Yucatán Peninsula. At this time, no one was sure what the large landmass to the east was. Some believed it was just another large island, while others continued to maintain, as Columbus always had, that it was the mainland of Asia. But Córdoba's expedition was ill-fated. They were attacked by local Maya, and 50 Spaniards were killed, with the expedition leader later dying of his wounds. The Córdoba expedition was followed in 1518 by another, led by the Spaniard Juan de Grijalva. This time, the Spaniards went with greater protection, arming their ships with small culverin cannons. Cortés doesn't seem to have paid much attention to these expeditions, perhaps occupied with his work. But when Juan de Grijalva failed to return from his voyage, and one search party sent to look for him also didn't return, a second rescue mission was put together. Cortés was chosen to lead this expedition. He wasn't the obvious choice. He had never led an army or commanded any kind of military post, But crucially, he had agreed to finance half the expedition himself. Velázquez was, as de Gomera records, somewhat stingy and had little stomach for spending. But the governor's orders were clear. This was not a true invasion of Mexico. That he hoped to lead himself in the coming years. Despite his inexperience, in just 1 month, Cortés was able to gather 300 men and 6 ships, ready for his rescue mission. But before they could set off, disaster struck, from Cortés's perspective. The men they were supposedly setting out to find sailed back into port. They brought back incredible stories of cities of tall pyramids and paved streets, and recounted meeting a delegation from a powerful king who was said to live there, named Moctezuma. With its raison d'etre vanished, and becoming increasingly nervous that Cortés was about to get all the glory of new discoveries, Governor Velázquez withdrew his support for the voyage, and even explicitly forbade Cortés from setting sail. Now, with a half-provisioned expedition and a great deal of his own money already spent, something rebelled in Cortés. With dreams of gold and conquest in his mind, Cortés decided to leave at once and proclaimed he was going on his own authority. He set sail on the 18th of November, 1518, telling his men, "I offer you great rewards, although they will be wrapped about with great hardships. I shall make you in a very short time the richest of all men who have crossed the seas." It's said that the governor hurried down to the docks to try to stop him, but arrived to find the ships already at sea. Stopping at ports along the Cuban coast, Cortés's force swelled to around 630 men, including crossbowmen and musketeers, sailing in 11 ships. Few of them were soldiers or had any military experience. Most were merchants and traders. They brought along a number of indigenous women, a few dozen African men, some enslaved, and others like the conquistador Juan Garrido, apparently freedmen. They packed the ships with 13 horses, a few cannons, and dogs trained for war. The invasion of Mexico had begun. The Grijalva expedition the previous year had caused quite a stir in Moctezuma's court. One morning, lookouts guarding the coast had sighted the Spanish ships in the distance, their tall white sails emblazoned with red crosses. The watchmen immediately paddled out on their canoes to investigate. They were led aboard the Spanish ships, where they made a sign of respect, as the Florentine Codex records. They entered the boats, and when they had drawn near to the Spaniards, then before them they performed the earth-eating ceremony at the prows of the boats. The Spaniards exchanged gifts of beads and textiles with them, and left with a promise that they would soon return. This small group of Mexica returned to the capital, obviously a little shaken by their encounter. Day by day, night by night, they travelled in order to come to warn Moctezuma, in order to come to tell him exactly of its circumstances. When they arrived, they were summoned to report to the king himself. These lowly watchmen from the coast would have come before the emperor barefoot, and would have bowed their heads when they spoke to him. Meeting his eyes would have been strictly forbidden. They gave their king the beads that the Spanish had given them, and then, as clearly as they could, they told him what they had seen. Moctezuma was clearly troubled by what he heard. Strange rumors must have been spreading around the region for years now. In 1512, a canoe of native Jamaicans had landed in Moctezuma's lands, apparently refugees from some terrible destruction that was being wrought there. A strange chest had even washed up on the shores of the Gulf of Mexico and been brought to Tenochtitlan for inspection, where it was found to contain several suits of bizarre clothes. Moctezuma was a cautious and pragmatic ruler, and his first instinct was always to seek out more information before acting. "No one shall speak anything of this," he told the men. "No one shall let it escape his lips. No one shall let any of it out. No one shall loose a word of it." He told them to return to the coast and establish a permanent watch there, in case the strangers in their large ships returned. But the days passed, and nothing more happened. The Aztec New Year soon came around. One of Moctezuma's favorite palace women bore him a new son. He watched performances of jugglers and dancing dwarves. Poets from Texcoco came to his palace and recited flowery poetry on life's fleeting nature, the flowery deaths of warriors, and the sorrow of loss. "What are you thinking? Why so serious, friend?" one such Mexica poem goes. "Do the flowers not please you, singer? The butterfly comes and goes like a flower. Let us suck honey from the flowers, from the clusters in our hands." Life in Tenochtitlan went on. But then, as the year drew to a close, more large ships were sighted on the horizon. Moctezuma ordered a delegation to go and meet these strangers and find out what they wanted. Cortes and his 11 ships had quickly made the short crossing from Cuba to Mexico and sailed for several weeks past overgrown sandbars and white sand beaches lapped by sapphire blue waters. Unknown to Cortes and his men, in mid-March of 1519, they passed over the exact spot where, 66 million years earlier, the Chicxulub asteroid had impacted the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs. Traveling at an average rate of 4 knots, or about 7 kilometers an hour, it would have taken the ships an entire day and night to cross the vast ring of its crater, invisible beneath the waves. One day, a lookout shouted that there was a canoe paddling out to meet them. Inside the canoe was a man dressed and tattooed in the style of a Mayan peasant. But they were astonished to hear him shout out in Spanish, "Gentlemen, are you Christians? Whose subjects are you?" This was Jerónimo de Aguilar, who had been shipwrecked 8 years earlier when trying to sail for Cuba. He had lived as a slave among the Maya before managing to escape, and had kept himself sane through those long years by obsessively keeping track of what weekday it was back in Europe. To his distress, he discovered that it was Sunday, when he had thought it to be a Wednesday. During his captivity, Aguilar had learned a little of the Yucatec Maya language of his captors, and seeing how useful he could be, Cortes enlisted him for his voyage, promising to take him back to Cuba when the mission was done. Needing to restock their water supply, Cortes's expedition stopped off at a large Mayan town named Potonchan, near the mouth of the Tabasco River. The locals came out to meet them armed, until the whole riverbank appeared to be covered with Indian warriors carrying all the different arms which they use, and blowing trumpets and shells and sounding drums, wrote one of Cortes's men, Bernal Diaz del Castillo. These Mayan people tried to drive the Spaniards away by force. "They boldly began to let fly arrows at us and made signals with their drums," Bernal Diaz writes. "And like valiant men, they surrounded us with their canoes. When Cortes let off his guns, the Maya panicked, and the horsemen got ashore and rode down 400 villages. The Mayan chief of Potonchan offered a formal surrender and handed over large amounts of gold and a group of 20 enslaved women as part of his tribute. One of these women would be christened Marina, but to the indigenous people of the region, she would come to be known with fear and reverence by the name Malintzin, the Tsin suffix in Nahuatl, acting as a sign of respect and submission. This woman had been enslaved from the Nahua-speaking borderlands of Coatzacoalcos before being sold to the lord of Potonchan. She had likely lived a rough life of abuse and servitude, but her experience meant that she now spoke both Mayan and Nahuatl. Her utility was immediately apparent. Cortes took her aside with Aguilar, writes de Gomera, and promised her more than her liberty if she would establish friendship between him and the men of her country as his interpreter and secretary. Between Malintzin and Aguilar, who spoke Mayan and Spanish, Cortes was now able to communicate in virtually any language in the region. He could now make any people he encountered understand his demands. And perhaps more importantly, he could lie. From the beginning, Cortes knew that he was on a potentially illegal mission. He had defied the Cuban governor, Diego de Velazquez, to whom some of the men aboard his ships were still somewhat loyal. For this reason, one of his first acts was to scuttle 10 of his 11 ships, ensuring that no one could sneak away and inform Velazquez of his whereabouts. He arranged with several of the sailing masters to have them hauled beyond the possibility of pumping or plugging them, de Gomera recounts. Future historians would embellish this story with the more dramatic burning of these ships, a part of the Cortes myth that evokes the classical Agathocles, the tyrant of Syracuse, who had once burned his ships on the beaches of Carthage. The 11th ship Cortes sent back to Spain with a letter to the King of Spain and Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, the first of five that he would write, and a collection of golden artifacts looted from nearby villages. This was clearly designed to go over Velazquez's head and legitimize the mission with an appeal to a higher authority. With the same aim in mind, Cortes put his legal knowledge to work and immediately founded a new town, which he called Veracruz, or the True Cross. It wasn't much of a town, likely a few tents and other temporary shelters huddled on the sandbanks. But Cortes furnished it with all the legal necessities, including a municipal council made up of several of his sunburned soldiers. In a legal sense, Cortes could now claim to be the governor of the new town, placing him on equal authority with Velazquez and empowering him to act on behalf of the king. Only a few days later, a group of Mexica men in fine feathers and cloaks arrived at Veracruz and announced that they were messengers of Emperor Moctezuma. They brought gifts of gold and incense, as well as food. Others were hidden among the trees, overlooking the beach. Moctezuma's finest court painters, sent with their brushes and paints to record everything they saw. Cortes made sure to give the Mexica a demonstration of his gunpowder weaponry, as the Florentine Codex records. They then shot the great Lombard gun, and the messengers indeed fainted away and swooned. They each fell, each one swaying fell. Cortes claimed that he was an ambassador sent by his king, who ruled the greater part of the world. He even ventured that some of his men were suffering from a disease of the heart, and that only the precious metal gold could be used as a treatment. He asked whether Emperor Moctezuma could help him and his men in getting some. The ambassador from Tenochtitlan, not sensing the danger, said that Moctezuma had a lot more gold in his capital of Tenochtitlan. Probably from that moment, the fate of the empire was sealed. Cortes decided then and there that he would march to Tenochtitlan and take the land for himself. He ordered his men to prepare to march.